This podcast is sponsored by Artsmark Award, the only creative quality standard for schools and education settings accredited by Arts Council England. Artsmark supports schools to develop and celebrate their commitment to arts and cultural education, providing a flexible framework to embed creativity across the whole curriculum. The programme supports the health and well-being of pupils and builds confidence, character and resilience through arts, culture and creativity. So put creativity and well-being at the heart of your curriculum with Artsmark. Register today at artsmark.org.uk.
Hello and welcome to this TES podcast to discuss why arts and creativity are essential to the recovery process as people settle back into school. Joining me today is Dr. Stephen Berryman, Director of Arts and Culture for the Odyssey Trust for Education, and the Visiting Research Fellow at King's College London and Guildhall School, and Dr. Zoe Mula, a postdoctoral research fellow with over 10 years' experience working in schools as a teacher and therapeutic arts practitioner. Thank you both for joining me today.
Good morning.
Now, during the first national lockdown in particular, we saw lots of people turning to creative pursuits. I mean, the pandemic really seemed to spark this collective creativity from musicians streaming live performances from their homes, huge participation in Grayson Perry's amazing art club, and amateur baking took off in a huge way. And I think people everywhere were creating TikTok videos, just to name a few of the things. Were there any new creative things that you got up to during lockdown?
I definitely did. I actually started things that I wanted to do from my childhood, and I just kept postponing back and back. For example, I always knew I wanted to start playing piano, and obviously I didn't go straight with the piano, but I thought I'll get a keyboard because I have so much free time now that why not? And so there were things that I wanted to do from my childhood and I just never had so much time to fully commit to. So that was really nice. And also starting paint by numbers, it's probably something you probably used to have children doing that, but I actually found that very relaxing. And it was the only thing for me that allowed me to focus on a single thing for plenty of hours. And I loved it.
Wow, that was quite disciplined.
I mean, I went back to the piano a lot. I mean, piano was my first instrument because I'm a musician. But I started playing the piano again, actually, having not played it for a little bit. And I walked past it every day. And when I set myself the challenge of playing some short pieces, I would play a different one each day. And then I started choosing ones I would learn for the week. Like by the end of the week, I would try and play this and I would record myself playing it. But you're right. It's a nice distraction from because we had so many Zoom calls, team meetings, Slack things. And so just having that space to just switch off from the screen and ironically look at another screen of piano music. But it was just great to just be again reconnecting with something that I did as a child and as an adult, but something I'd left for. And I think you're right that suddenly we had that space and capacity because we weren't commuting to reignite some of that creativity.
That's really interesting. You both went back to things that you took up in your childhood and refined them. Did you upload anything online or?
Not for public consumption. I did play for a concert for a livery company I'm in. They put on a concert of members and I thought, you know what, I'm going to submit something. And I've done a lot of concerts in my life, but it's amazing how you have to really tweak the camera, don't you? Because I'm not a filmer. I'm not a film person. So I had to find, how do I get the camera right on my piano to capture it? But it was a really good experience because I must have done, I don't know, 25 takes. It was really,
really?
I kept making a mistake thinking, oh no, I have to do it again. But it was really good. It was nice to go back that process again, because I think as teachers, we expect students to do that for us. And to have to go through the process of preparing something, psyching myself up to perform was really good. It was nice to recapture that.
Definitely. And do you think that this surge in creative spirit was just a case of, as you say, having that spare time on your hands or alleviating boredom for some people? Or were we looking for ways to process the situation? So I think for me, one of the most poignant early images of the pandemic was of the Italians playing music and singing from their balconies as the virus was ravaging their cities. Because of course, during all of this, the pandemic was and still is having a hugely detrimental effect on every sphere of our lives, particularly in terms of our mental health. Do
do you think that this collective creativity was a form of coping mechanism, or was it just that we had this extra time because of the restrictions?
I mean, Zoe, I don't know if you want to jump in there.
Yeah, I think for me it was definitely both. I certainly started things because I was looking for things to do, and normally I wouldn't have so much time to focus on painting and playing music. I just wouldn't focus so much for hours and hours without being in lockdown. So I think it was definitely part of spending time, but equally though, there were times that I felt the need, the very genuine need to create and get very much involved in the process of being creative. So for me, it was definitely both. There were times that I did it because I wanted to spend my time without necessarily even feeling like being creative. Then there were others that I felt that deep need to do that. A combination, probably.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it was definitely both. And I think what we saw thinking about music is that students, because perhaps at all levels, I mean, thinking of students who are postgraduates as well as in school settings, they weren't commuting, they had time to practice. So it meant that teachers, you know, on their Zoom lessons or however they might have been teaching, they were seeing improvements in ways they hadn't seen before. I think initially it was quite difficult to work in new ways and to work remotely, but slowly they were seeing students turning up to their lessons on time because they were at home already, they could be set up, they could log in, they would start on time. They were making progress because they had the capacity to practice and to work on things, be it things they were told to study or things they wanted to create or improvise themselves. So it was really great to see. And I think that what it's given families probably is an insight into that educational experience. Mm. So when before students might be going off to music lessons or art lessons, parents and carers wouldn't see that work. They wouldn't see the process. They wouldn't see the journey. But suddenly, because they are at home and were at home during the lockdown, parents became part of the process. Parents could see the practice, parents could see the lessons, parents could become aware of the creativity their children were doing in school settings, not just seeing the final thing, they could see the process. But I think also, as well as being obviously having this time issue, I think there was that collective need to do something collectively. And so seeing schools needing to make things, you know, some of those songs they might do where people record independently and then they piece it together, it's as if there was that acceleration of, we still need collective artworks. We still need to collaborate on things. We can't just do individual things. And so I felt there was an acceleration of that. But again, depending on your setting and the schools you work in, you know, having the technology, the experience to put those kinds of things together is demanding. But I think, yeah, I agree with Zoe. It's definitely both.
And where does this need to be creative come from, this need to have a creative outlet? Because the mental health benefits of arts and creativity are quite recognised now. Can you tell us a bit about the therapeutic effects of engaging in arts?
I think for me personally is that there are things that we just cannot express verbally. We might not have the words to do that, or the ways to do that, or the people to say that with sometimes. So being able to express these emotions and feelings in non-verbal ways, in ways that we all know, be it movement, music, sound, drawing, having that outlet that we don't need our words anymore. We can just express our feelings in different ways. It's especially important for children, considering that they have potentially limited vocabulary to express their feelings, or like sometimes in younger children may not have the communication skills to that. But even as adults, we see that we definitely struggle with that. And so I think for me, it's definitely that emotional expression and relief that comes, that can be really therapeutic, especially as Stephen said, when if we're able to share that with other people and get that mirroring in both ways, mm-hmm. It can really help to just allow us to say, oh, we're not alone. Even if we cannot verbally express how we feel, we're not alone here. And by sharing and expressing, I think the process can be really therapeutic on its own.
No, I agree with you completely. And I suppose I can think of some examples. I think there's been some research with choirs where, as if their heart rates somehow synchronize, and so there you can build that collective anxiety reduction through communal singing. And I think I also think about the idea of flow. As some being involved in an activity, somehow, as you say, there are people who, and young people who don't communicate perhaps don't communicate verbally. So there might be other ways they can communicate, as you say, through movement, and recognizing that these creative outlets do give some young people, particularly in some children who perhaps don't have certain verbal ways of expressing, you know, their issues or things they need to talk about, they can do that through other means. And it's been remarkable, actually, seeing some of the lockdown artwork that students have used, created. And you can see how for some it has been a way of processing their current reality and dealing with things they've had to think about. And I suppose they might have experienced loss. They might have experienced loss within their family, or they might have experienced loss in families they know. And how you process that and digest that. And even because I experienced a bereavement as a child, and I think when you're very young, you don't really have the opportunity to talk about it. And so I guess if you have a hobby like sketching, or you're doing a lot of, I don't know, drawing or music making, so that is going to somehow merge into your feelings and emotions about things that are happening around you. And somehow you're going to be processing through your activity. I mean, I think that's more anecdotal than research for me, but certainly I can see it in the work students are producing. You can see a change, and you can see that acknowledgement of what they are picking up around them.
Yes, because you've both done quite a bit of work looking into the impact the pandemic has had on young people's well-being. Do you see that the arts is being a part of this recovery process, and is it something that schools can learn from, this idea of creativity as an outlet or medium through which to process experiences?
I'm going to jump in and say yes. I think partly because there's a real danger at this point where I feel for school leaders, because they have a lot of challenges to make. And I suppose one challenge was that COVID security of certain artwork, certain art forms, involving, say, equipment or singing. Obviously, COVID rules were saying you could not do that. You can't sing, you can't share equipment. And so I feel for art subjects, because suddenly their normal ways of working were deemed unsafe. And so lots of arts teachers, I think, lost their confidence about how do I teach now during this pandemic when I can't use my equipment in the same way, I can't work with groups in the same way. And so much of our work is with groups. So much of our work is in a space. So much of our work involves specialist equipment that involves multiple people touching it. And so suddenly we were chucked into an environment of how do we do this? We had to rapidly adapt our ways of working, and seeing people rapidly adapt and pivoting to digital has been remarkable. But I think school leaders have then made decisions where, oh, we've got to put classes in non-specialist spaces to maintain bubbles. So suddenly teachers are being told, I need you to teach music, but you can't have any equipment and you can't use your room. And so that's a huge challenge. So I guess the message really is that the more schools can see the kinds of works that young people have created during the pandemic, the way they've used this as a way of processing those experiences, they need to be reminded, don't jeopardize your arts curriculum. Don't put it in non-specialist spaces. You can make it work despite the reality of COVID. Don't start cutting the timetable to put more time into something else because you think, oh, they've missed out on English and maths. Let's do more of that. Do the opposite. Just maintain your broad and balanced curriculum, maintain the integrity of your art subjects, because they will be so important in the months ahead.
And Zoe, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that described it perfectly, Stephen. I could see a few benefits out of that. For example, because exactly teachers had to create smaller groups of children and potentially not as many materials as they used to have before, since some children shouldn't touch other children's materials. I think it did create an environment where we had to appreciate smaller things and doing more with less. I noticed, for example, some children before, because we used to provide them with so many materials and things to do, they almost got distracted in a way from that process of slowing down and appreciating the moment of creating. But by having, okay, you're finding little things, we can create things instead of giving them all this huge amount of materials. I think actually, so for some children, it did work in the sense of creating from very little resources. And so being able to appreciate very small things and their potential creative or artistic use of smaller things. So I would say that's of course, it wouldn't apply to everyone and every child, but definitely I could see some children, I could notice some changes in some of the children, if that makes sense.
Zoe, can I jump in? I completely agree with you, actually, that you had to be so ingenious with the minutiae of things. Mm-hmm. And say you've got restricted materials, and also lots of young people did not have materials at home. And so, again, teachers have to think creatively about how do I deliver this project when they don't have paints, they don't have X or Y. And you're right. And I think that is something we all take away as arts teachers, that we've had to rethink the nature of our work in a way. There's lots of positives around that. As you say, focusing on more limited resources as a way of really pushing our creativity. But also, I think because we couldn't do those usual events, particularly like music and drama, you couldn't have productions, you can't have an audience. I suppose it's pushed a lot of people to really think about that in-class experience and their curriculum in a way they probably haven't done or done so deeply for a while, because they had to balance it against productions, doing exhibitions and doing their extracurricular stuff. So I wonder if that's another positive as well, as focusing on the minutiae and those limited resources, you know, positively, but also having to really think about your curriculum more deeply to make it work in a virtual realm as well as a blended realm, as it now, you know, as we transition back into schools again.
Absolutely. And it forces us to experiment with new things that we hadn't even thought about before, but you just have to. And I think that experimentation is good, because we are working with our creativity without even realizing by doing that.
Yeah, agreed.
And do you see that the arts themselves and tapping into that creative side is really important for students' recovery process, in terms of helping them settle back in and re-engage with learning and address the mental health issues that have arisen during the pandemic, and actually those that have been exacerbated? Because I think the Royal College of Psychiatrists says that new mental health issues have arisen, but it's a kind of crisis on top of a crisis, because the pandemic has highlighted and really intensified existing problems in child mental health.
I think so. I think actually so much of the way we work in the arts is through group work, is through conversation, is through collaboration. And I think when classrooms were becoming these COVID secure zones, individual desks, I think that's become a way of working for many subjects. So in a way, the arts provide a counter to that individualized education, because we need them to work together. And I think that through creating something together, something happens. And I think, you build a community again, you reaffirm connections. And I think that's why it's so important we do engage with this. And so much of this mental health crisis will come down to young people that have not been able to engage or interact with people that are important to them in a meaningful way. And whilst they can interact on devices, it won't feel the same for many. So the arts provide that vehicle for that interaction, that collaboration, and that feeling of we've made this together, we achieved this together, and it represents our communal, our collective thinking. And I think that's what we need to provide for them, to help them to kind of feel safe, secure, but also to help to deal with it, give them those spaces to deal with these anxieties that have developed. And I suppose in drama, when young people are doing, say, verbatim theatre or devised work, they can bring in these feelings, they can bring in these problems and issues that they're grappling with as a vehicle for creative work. Whilst in other subjects, there might not be the space for those conversations because they might be driven by content or specification demands. The arts have a space to bring in student voice, student interests. So it's a perfect vehicle to tackle it.
And also I guess that collaboration will help to heal some of the maybe disrupted friendships and help that socialisation of being back in that unit when they probably are quite used to having been isolated for so long.
Exactly. I mean, there were a lot of studies on the impact of the school closures. There was a big systematic review with from around 20 countries, and there were around 30 studies that showed how much it was more than 0.5% since before COVID, basically, the feelings of isolation that children had experienced. And I think we tend to also forget that not every child's home is safe. Not every child has this kind of nice experience with their parents or siblings. So schools for many children are their safe space. So by taking that out, on the top of the obviously isolation, losing their friends, social contact, the mental health impact is massive. So I think it did make us realize that schools are not just for the grades then, are not to go and learn and pass exams. It's much more than that. It's much more than that.
So do you think that that is the case? I think one of the great things that came out of the whole pandemic was this recognition of the vital role schools play in our communities. As you say, you know, not just in terms of our help, you know, helping our economy function, but in socialization of young people, creating those well-rounded individuals and supporting their well-being. Because we know that, as you said, when schools moved to online learning, a vast system of support for children and their families were consequently curtailed. So do you think there is now more awareness that education is about more than a testing regime and getting a grade? Because you said that parents were now more aware of what their children were doing in terms of practicing instruments and doing creative work as well as their day-to-day education curriculum.
Yes, definitely. I mean, certainly the Confederation of School Trusts talks about the trusts of school being civic, having a civic responsibility. They are more than buildings. They are more than their own communities. They have an impact on their local community. And I've certainly seen this firsthand, you know, sort of a challenge with free school meal vouchers. The fact that families relied on, as you know, as Zoe said, we assume that this must be great for them to not be in school. But, you know, right, Zoe's right, that for many, schools are the safest place they can be. And so being denied that, being denied access to a safe space, being denied access to a meal, is you know, difficult. So I think the public gained a real insight into the challenge for young people and children who are going to schools when they can't go to school and what they miss out on. And then also the just huge amount of compassion and care from school teachers to step up and try and fill those gaps in those services that we feel young people need, be it because of the mental health support, those welfare visits they were doing, so, you know, sending work home to those children that didn't have access, be it digital or broadband, laptops. And it was a real grapple for resource and support. But I think schools have done it. They've just learned a lot more about their families probably during this period than they ever have, because they've had to step up and fill the gaps.
And probably an appreciation for the teacher, the role of the teachers as well. I mean, I know from my own background how much in Greece, where I grew up, we used to kind of criticize teachers, to put it lightly, for not teaching enough or not helping students progress enough. But actually now realize, well, that's not the only role that teachers have. It's much more than that. And I think by looking at least my social media, there was a tendency towards really starting to appreciate how important teachers are and their role, not only in the educational system, but also in the lives of the children as a whole.
Yeah, I agree. And I think perhaps there's a lot of pressure on teachers now to be much more than teachers. They're having to be social workers. They're having to be surrogate parents. And I wonder if that's a healthy thing for teacher well-being long term, because schools now are being expected to step up to be these civic institutions that are such a huge part of their communities and stepping up and filling the gaps of other public services. You do wonder in the long term, is this putting too much pressure on schools? Should they be fulfilling this purpose, or should we be somehow rebalancing it? So I guess it's all about what you think education is. And I agree, it is so much more than testing. It is so much more than getting a grade. And that really has been illuminated. And that's why we've got things like rethinking assessment. And that's why we've got, you know, School 21 showing us actually there are different ways to do this. And out of this pandemic, maybe these bigger conversations about the purpose of schools and what schools can be and what young people need now and in the future, it makes sense that that will all come out of this current reality and this current pandemic.
Do you think that is the case, that this will see the light, this narrative of well-being and reassessing assessment? Do you think that will actually come to light? Or do you think, you know, because of the bleak economic outlook, that schools might start prioritising core subjects and skills such as literacy and numeracy? Because there is this narrative dominating education at the moment of COVID catch-up.
I think personally the latter might be more prevalent personally. Maybe I'm a little bit cynical, But I think it depends on the capacity to dream big, doesn't it? I guess if you're on a school or a role that gives you the capacity to dream about the future and think big, then you have the space to do public proclamations about what's important to you, about the need for to enhance young people's well-being. But I guess if you're in a setting where you don't have that capacity to dream and really think about the future, you're going to be grounded in the reality of now and feeling the pressures of they need to catch up in this, I need them to get through this. So I guess it's all about how much space and capacity do you have as a leader to think about the future and balance that the next with the now. And I worry if a lot of schools, based on the pressures they're under, are grounded in the now so much so that dreaming about the future is quite hard to do.
I think especially because there's already reports that the arts are being cut to allow for COVID catch-up.
Yes, there are. I know that's hard to, it's hard to battle. Certainly in my context, you do all you can to communicate that value, just to demonstrate the impact it can have and demonstrate the support it can be for other domains within a school setting. That's what we have to do. I think we have to keep communicating how this can support broader educational priorities.
And we, of course, we have to be quite careful about perpetuating a narrative that's going to have a detrimental impact on how children see themselves in their future if they're being panicked to being told they need to catch up. So I think that was something that the Children's Commissioner raised about not panicking children on how far they've fallen behind, but you know, perhaps focusing as much on helping boost their well-being and catching up on their social experiences as well.
It's quite challenging, isn't it? I mean, but with my experience in different schools in different countries, I know that the UK has a lot of quality controls in the way that the schools have to meet. So it seems to me that it's less, the schools might have less flexibility in some aspects to even if they would like to promote the arts and then the well-being of children. It's also about meeting those targets that they have been set nationally on national standards. So I think that makes a situation even more difficult. I think it's good to some sense that we have all these controls in place, but it does mean that schools may not be able to prioritize the things that they would like to. And I've seen great leaders that would like to promote arts and would like to promote mental health, but it's just really hard to meet the academic standards at the same time.
Yeah, agreed. I think it takes a real brave, courageous leader to think, actually, this is really important. I know it's important. And I think anecdotally, all the conversations you have with arts teachers, arts flourish in a school when a leader believes in it. And I think head teachers and executive leaders, they have to believe in the arts if it's going to flourish in a setting. And so the more they can be brave and courageous to maintain the arts and to not jeopardize it by removing it from the curriculum or reducing its support or resource, that's what we need. And I suppose we need that messaging from a department so they recognize that this is important. Don't let this be jeopardized amidst the challenge of now. Don't diminish the arts in your school. This is an important part of a broad and balanced curriculum. It supports well-being, health and well-being. And this will enable your young people to regain that socialization and regain that safe, secure well-being they'll need for their future.
So you think it mostly needs to come from the leaders themselves?
Yes.
And step up and be brave.
Completely, undeniably so, I think. If the leaders have to be fully on board with the arts being important parts of their school. So I think the more we have department messaging about the essential nature of the arts and cultural education, the better.
And more specifically, what can teachers do? I mean, given all the competing priorities that they have and the varying levels of need they're faced with now, how can they go about incorporating the arts, especially given you said that a lot of them might have lost their confidence, given a lot of their materials they can't really use right now and the ways that they were working before have changed?
I think keeping connected with your subject association is really, really important in all the arts, actually. We all have thriving subject associations, which, because for many departments, say a music department, I think 70% of secondary schools have a single music teacher. So you're not in a team. If you're a maths teacher, a science teacher, you're often in a big team. You can share resources, you can chat about approaches, you can figure out this pivoting to digital collectively. If you're on your own, you've got no one. So reaching out to your subject association in a way to reignite your passion, reignite your thinking about how you might approach things, get new project ideas. So I think reaching out is important. But also, I guess, if you're a non-arts teacher and you're thinking, I've got a feeling the arts could be really valuable, how could I support them? Maybe I'm a science teacher. Maybe go and speak to an arts teacher. Say, I'm teaching this. I would love to hear about some creative approaches. You might even look at the Creativity Exchange the Arts Council launched earlier this year, a platform to show you how you can teach with and for creativity, regardless of subject. So there's lots of support out there, regardless of your subject. If you feel, I want to be more creative here, I want to encourage this through artistic means or through artistic domains, just reach out to your arts department, look at the Creativity Exchange, chat to your subject association. There's lots out there.
And it's the perfect time for that, isn't it? Because there is that culture of support at the moment, isn't there? There's a huge community, everyone's sharing resources and sharing ideas about how to do that. So it's really a time for that teachers can feel comfortable doing that, asking for, you know, for some ideas and some support there.
Exactly. I was about to say that because of COVID, I think there was a huge rise on all the digital resources. In a way, we could get lost in how many stuff there is out there, how many wonderful creative activities that teachers can use. I imagine that it's just because we spend so much time online, the last thing that we want sometimes is to look for resources that are, again, digital, but actually there's a lot out there. Even spending like half an hour looking for it, surely there are a lot of great things that can be found to experiment with children. I would say also we tend to live in a very kind of visual world, so we would ask children to maybe draw or paint, but actually trusting our senses, like smell, touching, you know, we can do so many creative things by using our senses and all, even with very, very limited materials and resources. I think, yeah, just using the things that we have and are kind of natural, such as our senses, it could help, especially in places where there are not enough resources potentially.
I really like that. That's a really lovely point, actually, because I think, you know, challenging yourself as a teacher to consider a student's creating responses in a different way than they did. So rather than writing an essay, how differently might they do that? And it says that's what it is to be creative, isn't it? Mm. It's not about painting a picture every time or drawing, as you say, is the only way of doing a different response. But how might you communicate this in a different way that communicates more powerfully what you're trying to convey? And challenge yourself to not do the conventional, don't write an essay. What else might you do? How might you give a response to this and give young people the space to respond, I suppose, space to use their own interests and intuition? How do I feel comfortable about sharing what I want to say about, you know, a topic or a book or whatever you're teaching? So, yeah, I think you can encourage that, definitely.
Yeah, listening, smelling, touching things, all those great mm-hmm. things can be used.
And that's a really important skill for them to have in education, but also in life, being able to come up with that, a unique response, you know, very something that's personalized to them, you know, having that belief in their own ideas and following them through to express them creatively, not just what they think a teacher might want to hear, but actually thinking of a different way to respond.
No, completely agree. And actually, this really ties back to what you were saying earlier about this mental health crisis, because once we start giving a space for young people to express things in the way they feel more comfortable doing or the way they need to creatively, that's going to help boost self-esteem and boost their well-being, I feel.
Yeah, and make them much more confident learners because they're not afraid to express how they're feeling. There's not that fear of it being wrong or failing, and that's something that's transferable across the curriculum and can, you know, help educational outcomes as well because they're more confident, they're more engaged.
Yeah, no, completely agree.
And given that we've spoken a lot about the issue of mental health issues for the youth, what about all the pressures that teachers are under? Because you said they were taking on so much during the pandemic, during lockdown. What can they do to try and protect their mental health and each other's right now? They're going to be faced with a lot of pressure to try and, you know, deal with all these varying needs and, you know, COVID catch up and the pressure from parents. How has it disrupted their children's learning? How can teachers protect their mental health so they can do the best for the children they can?
I think sharing is really important to that. I know it's sometimes admitting that, you know, I'm struggling at the moment. It can be received as a weakness often, but it's really important to be able to acknowledge how I feel like I'm struggling right now. And it's good to share. Sometimes our colleagues might not know how much we're struggling, by saying, oh, I'm not feeling great, it's the extent, the degree to what we don't feel great. Our colleagues and potential supervisors might not be able to understand that. So I think it's quite important when we realize that we reach a stage where we've had so much and we're overwhelmed, that it's really important to share that at the earliest possible stage rather than postponing it until we reach a stage of burnout or really not cope with the situation. And I think that's why it's the conversations around health need to be broad, be more and acceptable about these things. There was a great survey from the Anna Freud Center, and it was from more than 3,000 children in primary schools. They said that it was around 90% of the children said that they want conversations around their mental health to be normalized, because they don't feel comfortable enough to share things. So it's really important if they feel that way. Surely the teachers will feel that way, that they might not be able to share as much as they would like to. So I think the normalization, destigmatization as well of mental health is really important. We're making steps towards improvements in those things, but it's important to keep talking about and keep bringing this up.
It's a really good point, Zoe, because I think Professor Rob Coe was talking about this the other day, in that we take the curriculum of young people so seriously, we now need to take the curriculum as seriously. So we need to think really carefully. We were thinking about catch up for young people. We're thinking about the school day for young people. Are we doing the same thing for teachers? Are we thinking about now there are teachers who are juggling caring responsibilities with having to teach from home? Do they have the equipment to do their job properly? Do they have it? Is it set up in a safe way? Is it set up in an ergonomically good way so they can function well? What other constraints and problems are they dealing with whilst they're juggling their job? But also, does it feel right to expect them to do these meetings like this? Does it feel right for them to have to be there? How does it feel for them to have a visor on all day? How does it feel for them to have to be cleaning desks? And I wonder if there's been enough acknowledgement of that, or we've just assumed, okay, here's the protocols, here's the document, I need you to follow that. You're a professional, get on with it. But I wonder, do we need to give them the same care we're giving children in terms of actually, how did it feel to do that week? How did it feel to spend your day wearing a visor? How did it feel to teach with a mask on? How are you? And do we do that enough, or do we just get on with it and we just be professionals rather than humans? I don't know. And that's certainly, I feel we've not had enough of that in education. And I think teachers need that. They need to be treated with care and courtesy and just to be feel like they're acknowledged as a human being.
Of course, because it all happened so suddenly, didn't it? Especially in January, it was you're in school one day and the next day, actually, it's lockdown. And they've come back and they're teaching, class with children wearing masks. How difficult must that be?
I know, it's psychological. I would just wonder if there's been enough acknowledgement of the peculiarity of that situation. Mm-hmm. And I admire teachers immensely for the agility from which they pivoted to digital. And I know colleagues who were terrified of the idea, how would I teach an online lesson? And actually being in a university setting as well as a school setting and seeing the just thorough nature of how in the university sector, the university I work for, they were really careful about how do we move to online lectures? How are we going to do this? What does it mean to do this? And you think, actually, you had the capacity to think about this. You had dedicated teams to think about it. You had dedicated teams to train staff, to reflect on it, to evaluate it. But schools, rapid movement, but with minimal reflection, minimal preparation, minimal resourcing. And so in a way, it's a testament to the teachers' resilience and just sheer brilliance that they did that. But I do think they deserve now time to reflect and deserve now that support to just, how are you? How did it feel? How's it going? And I wonder if this is where things like coaching can be so valuable, just to give them the space to talk about it rather than just rush on to the next initiative. Because I think that's what we have a danger of in education. We rush on to the next thing, but we don't pause and reflect enough.
Yeah, that's right. As you were saying, you know, you need a really brave head teacher who's going to say, actually, we're going to stop and we're going to pause. We're not thinking about, you know, the summer schools for COVID catch up. We're thinking about just taking a pause, checking on everybody's mental health before you know, sweeping on and making these changes, whether it be in technology or whatever it is that we're doing in school.
Agreed, because every new thing you do, people have to stop doing something else. Mm. And I think all the new COVID things meant what was stopping, what were teachers not doing whilst they were cleaning desks, whilst they were sorting out visors, whilst they were cleaning equipment, whilst they were quarantining books, what was stopping? And if people actually reflected about, wow, what have we stopped doing as a school? Were those things that we just didn't need to do and were making no difference? Or actually, have we stopped doing things that we need that were making a difference to young people? Should we pause and reflect? And this is what arts are so good at, because we instinctively pause and reflect. And I think this is why heads and leaders should rely on their art staff. Can you help us? How can we reflect on this? How might we use the arts to enable us to just pause, capture our learning, capture the positives, but also acknowledge the challenge so we can move on with purpose and real insight from the past, rather than put a kind of full stop on the pandemic and just move on as if it never happened, which I think there's a real risk we could do that in education, which would be a missed opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. And I think to finish, we'll have a crystal ball gazing question. Is there anything that you would like to see happen within education in the next 5 years, given we're hoping there's going to be this dream where we'll reassess how we're operating and how the curriculum looks and what we're doing for young people and indeed in the school with leaders and teachers? So should we come to you first?
Yeah, sure. The first thing that comes to my mind is that being able to slow down a bit, and it doesn't mean the entire time during class to slow down, but having even 10 minutes, 15 minutes in the class where it's a time to slow down and calm. We don't have to label it or name it meditation or mindfulness. It's literally just slowing down. And we see as adults, we're getting older, we cannot stop overthinking, cannot stay still for 10 minutes. So I think training children to the ability, because it's a very, very useful ability over time, it's really important. I think arts could link to that, because it's we get into the process of flow, of being fully involved into a single thing without thinking about anything else. So in a way, that can help that slowing down process. But with or without arts, I think for me, it's really important to make a bit more time, even 10 minutes in a day, to know that the children can do just that, slow down, stay still, notice what's around you, be grateful of the things that are happening to us. So I would love to see a change on that.
So having a kind of slow down period before, say, the school bell, rather than this rush to finish the lesson until the very last minute, but actually let's wind down and then move on to the next thing.
Exactly.
I think I would love to see a more coherent alignment between cultural organizations, artists, and schools, and just feel that schools are places of culture and museums, galleries, arts organizations are places of learning. And somehow those relationships, it's just normal for you to interact. I would love for every school to have a relationship with a gallery, to have a relationship with an organisation in their area, in their community. So they're working in partnership to make the arts really successful in their schools. We can never do it alone. And I think the arts are always going to be expensive. So in a way, it doesn't matter how much money you pump at it, it's never going to be as great as we'd like it. What we have to see is we've got this wonderful ecology of arts, practitioners, you know, those who might be working in more therapeutic spaces, as well as people who are making their own art. How do we make these microcosms of artistic worlds where every school is just part of these artistic worlds and their communities? I would love to see that. So it's just normal for artists to be in and out of schools all the time, rather than it being a nice to have or once a year thing.
That's wonderful, because that would really help, you know, give provision to all children as well.
Agreed.
Sometimes it can just get pushed to where it's, you know, it's expected in independent schools, but it's not always built into the curriculum elsewhere.
Yeah, no, I think we want to, that would be another, but can I have a second one? I think that every child gets access to art. It has to be something that you don't have to pay for if it's going to be something that every child can access. And I think whilst it remains a preserve of those who can afford it, we are never going to reach those young people on the margins, or those, you know, young people in the peripheral, you know, peripheries of our schools. We have to make it a universal provision. And it has to be more than saying it, such as in the recent modern music curriculum. It's fine in a department document saying we want universal access to music, but saying it in a document doesn't make it reality. And it's just, it's expensive. So we need to rethink, how do we enable schools to provide this access to arts, artists, music in a way that every child gets it? And I guess fundamentally, you need to target those kids first who are at risk of not getting it as a priority. But yeah, that would be great in 5 years' time. Every child has experienced an instrument. Every child has met an artist. Every child has visited a, you know, so having cultural commitments that people actually achieve would be wondrous.
Well, maybe let's meet back in 5 years and hope that this has all happened. Why not? Well, thank you both very much for your time. It's been really interesting speaking to you both.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.
It was really nice, really interesting conversation for me.
This podcast is sponsored by Artsmark Award, the only creative quality standard for schools and education settings accredited by Arts Council England. Artsmark supports schools develop and celebrate their commitment to arts and cultural education, providing a flexible framework to embed creativity across the whole curriculum. The programme supports the health and well-being of pupils and builds confidence, character and resilience through arts, culture and creativity. So put creativity and well-being at the heart of your curriculum with Artsmark. Register today at artsmark.org.uk.